When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Day one of no speaker vacation. Evidently, the children in Congress, left to their own vices, have gone and spread in all kinds of mischief and mayhem. So what did they do? What did the children do today when they had no work? Kind of like a snow day, if you will, for Congress, of their own making. You know, it's kind of like they pulled the fire alarm and now they get the benefit of it. So what did they do with 13 months away from the 2024 election? What are they going to bring to the American people? Well, what did our bow tie wearing Wall Street puppet interim speaker Patrick McHenry do today? Well, he kicked Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer out of their offices. Really? That's the first club out of the bag. We're gonna go get Pelosi and Hoyer. We'll show them. And this is just the beginning. Expect more musical offices. Because, look, they have no agenda. And understand, they did this on purpose. They did this on purpose so the story would be, they kicked Nancy Pelosi out of her office while she's in California at Dianne Feinstein's funeral. And, that's the story. Not the fact that the House is on fire. The Republican Party has set the House on fire. And they have no way of putting this fire out. Now, what you hear is, we should just calm down. You know, they're going to work through it. No, this is unprecedented. This is unprecedented. And it's who they are. So what did our children do? What did our reality stars in Real Nitwits of Washington, D.C. do today? Well, you had Marjorie Three Names and the rest of her kook caucus. They were doing the podcast circuit. Spewing a bunch of nonsense, heard a lot of, this is the Democrats' fault. I'm going, really? You're the majority. And I got to tell you, the more I watch the Kook Caucus, the more I watch the Republicans do their thing, the more I realize that they don't really want to govern. They don't really want to be in power because they don't have an idea of what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. These are people who want a beauty contest. They want a popularity contest. They have no idea. They barely found the bathroom, let alone know how to legislate, know how to compromise, know how to govern. No clue. They want a popularity contest. And it shows. And what it shows is they don't want to be in they don't want to be in the majority. They want to be the minority. They want to be the bomb throwers. They want to be the guy who stands up and says, no. But we didn't ask you a question. No. I mean, that's all they want to do. They don't know anything else. And here's the thing. We pay them. This is the brilliant part. We're paying them to do nothing. You know, we used to joke about the do-nothing Congresses of the past. Well, they're doing something, literally burning the house down. And, kicking Pelosi and Hoyer out of their offices. And look, this happens occasionally. This kind of tit for tat, I'll show you kind of, I'm in charge kind of thing. It happens. Don't care about it. Not even a little bit. What I care about is there's no agenda. None whatsoever. And I love the fact that Patrick McHenry, the bow tie wearing interim speaker, who's the puppet of Wall Street, evidently not a chance he's going to be the speaker, because Representative Garrett Graves of Louisiana said, hell no. I think there's a scenario where Patrick McHenry could be this for an extended period of time. Hell no. No. So he's not going to be the guy. So who is? We've heard the name Jim Jordan thrown around. In fact, I got to be honest, I don't know why Jordan would peek his head out. Because if he's actually a serious contender for the speakership, get ready to hear all about Jim. Not J-I-M, G-Y-M. Get ready to hear about all of the exploits at Ohio State, all of the sex scandal, all of the stuff that he covered up, all of the whining and crying and all the trying to get people to turn on each other. Oh, that will be the story. So I'm not sure why Jim Jordan's throwing his name, other than he's just a power-hungry monger who was willing to step on anyone to get ahead. There's that. And Steve Scalise, I'm not sure why Scalise wants it. He's suffering. He's fighting blood cancer. I'm like, he could be dead not too long. How about, you know, I don't know, maybe taking care of that. And then, well, then the funny thing comes in. Sean Hannity throws in, let Donald Trump be speaker. We want Donald Trump. And Marjorie Three Names goes on Alex Jones. And says, yes, we want Donald Trump. He's the only one I'll vote for. And you go, I'm actually in favor of that. Please show the country that you have no idea how to govern, that you in a legislative body can't choose among you someone to lead you, that you have to go outside of the institution entirely to get a reality TV star to come in and lead this cavalcade of crazy. And what's interesting is Trump said a lot of people have called me about speaker. All I can say is, we will do whatever is best for the country and other Republican Party and people. I'm not sure what that means, but not ruling it out. Again, no agenda, no idea. And what's interesting to me, the people that I talked to today, I threw it out. I said, what do you think of Trump as speaker? It was like someone won the Super Bowl. The people that I were talking to was like, oh my God, that would be the greatest thing ever. They don't know what the speaker does or, you know what Trump would do as speaker. They just want him because they know it's going to tick off the libs. And as someone who I guess I'm fairly liberal, it doesn't tick me off at all. In fact, it would make me very happy if you did something really that stupid, that colossally stupid. Because it would make the institution even less functional, if that's possible. If it is possible for the first time in history to have ousted a speaker if this isn't chaotic enough, not quite sure what is. Now, the other part of this is, while they have no agenda, they're not going to have any money. Because one thing that McCarthy's vindictive. You know, he's one of those guys, he's kind of a weasel. But he was a money-raising machine. And now when you pull him out of that, who's going to fill the coffers? Who's going to fill, the campaign money? Because, McCarthy's like, man, you're going to me to kick around no more. Going to be interesting to see how this plays out. And again, I think the Dems are doing the right thing. Just sit back, pop some popcorn. Throw your feet up, if your office isn't being taken away from you, and just watch the reality show, because truth be told, nothing was going to get done anyway. So show the American people how dysfunctional the Republican Party is, and let the chips fall where they may. Now, Democrats, as I've always said, have this need almost. I don't know if it's a maternal need to save people, to take care of people, but some Democrats, they feel the need to come in and save the day. And Democratic Congressman from Minnesota, Dean Phillips, tweeted out. There's part of me that goes, I got two thoughts on this. One is he's trying to bail them out. And two is that, maybe I agree with him. And here's what he tweeted. I care deeply about restoring faith in government, which is why I'll consider any speaker candidate of competency and integrity who's willing to place people in principle over politics, improve the institution of Congress, and lead America to bipartisan higher ground. Now, there's part of me going, well, you know, he's willing to, you know, he's willing to bail out the Republican Party. He's willing to save them from himself. That's what Democrats do. But then I read it a second time, and I'm going, okay, he'll consider a speaker who's competent and has integrity. Well, that rules out three quarters of the Republican Party right there. Principle over politics, I'm going to go with probably the rest of them. Improve the institution of a bunch of people who don't believe in the institution, tell you that it doesn't do anything, it shouldn't do anything. And then higher ground, a bipartisan higher, that's nobody. There's literally nobody to vote for in the Republican side of the aisle that fits any of those things. So there's part of me that goes, well, you know, it is what it is. This was a nice way of politicking a little bit, throwing it out there, saying, of course I'd be willing to help. If there was this mythical, if there was a unicorn out there that could possibly do, you know, the things that I've laid out. And in that vein, I'm not going to beat him up. Now, the fact that he left Democratic leadership over Biden, you know, seeking re-election, that's just plain, I don't get, but it is what it is. Now, what we do know is while the train wreck is going on in the House and the children are running amok, James Comer, he is the House Oversight Chair, he says they're going to stick with their impeachment inquiry of Biden. He said, you know, he believes the committee could legally continue its work without having an actual speaker. He thinks they can. And this is one of those things where you go, you think you can? Again, that's right. We're in uncharted waters. Never happened before. Now, again, as I said a moment ago, the reality is Republicans are going to continue to tell us that government is broken. It's broken. We need to tear everything down. We need to start over. We need to reinvent the widget. And the reality is government is not broken. Government works just fine. It's the Republican Party that's broken. They're broken. They're the ones who have broken this. Once you take them out of the equation, once you put them back into their much cherished, much sought after minority role, things work pretty well. Because if you remember, Nancy Pelosi had a much slimmer margin than McCarthy had. And yet somehow, she became speaker, didn't agree to a whole bunch of insanity, and actually got stuff done. Shock of shock. Now, understand, and I get this, that the Republicans have some lunacy problems, that maybe the Democrats don't. But look, the Dems have some far out folks on their side too. It's called keeping your people in together and not agreeing to stupidity. So we're going to see what happens and where this takes us. But I got a lot to get to, a lot to talk about. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the big story today, 75,000 workers hit the picket line today, healthcare workers across the country. And look, this was coming. We knew it was coming because I look at the fact that Kaiser Permanente reported in the first two quarters $4.5 billion in profit. $4.5 billion. Their CEO pocketed $15.6 million, but here you've got workers who are working for pretty close to poverty wages. And this is, again, another one of those moments of working people who have just had enough. So in Virginia and Washington, D.C., you had workers walking off the job at 6 o'clock this morning. They're going to go on strike, I guess, for one day. In California, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, they went on strike at 9 o'clock this morning. I believe they're going to be out for 3 days, if I'm not mistaken. But you've got this coalition of unions that represent some 85,000 workers for at Kaiser Permanente. And they're saying, look, we've got major staffing shortages. Those major staffing shortages are leading to potential unsafe conditions. You know, someone, you know, emailed me the other day and said, you know, the number three cause of death in this country is medical errors. And I'm like, I haven't checked that, but someone sent that to me and I'm going, I don't know that to not be true based on the fact that we have a system that is set up where profit is sacrosanct, where we're squeezing the quarter till the eagle screams. And, you know, working conditions be damned, staffing levels be damned. And look, you know, you end up having longer wait times. There's massive patient neglect. There's all kinds of stuff that we should be focusing on. And that's what this is about. Yeah, it's about the wages. It's about the benefits. But it's about the conditions. It's about the fact that these nurses and these workers are going, hey, we need the resources. We need the staffing levels. We need the ability to take care of people and do our jobs. They're also fighting to say, look, you know, we want to make sure that our work doesn't get outsourced and subcontracted and sliced and diced and given away. We want to have ownership of our work so that we have control of those circumstances. Because what happens is they bring in contract people who, well, you know, they can get rid of them anytime they want. Those workers don't have any voice, any say. So what these healthcare workers are saying, look, we want to have some skin in how our patients are cared for. And I've got to tell you, that's important. I say this all the time. Nurses are the greatest people in the world, with hands down, without question. I listen to the doctor sometime, but when the doctor says something, I then go to the nurse and I go, you know, is what he said right? Because they seem to know. They seem to know more. Because they deal with people. They seem to understand things. So I'm hoping they reach an agreement. They've been bargaining since April. The contract expired on September 30th, and they said, hey, look, at some point we got to pull the trigger. So you're going to see a day-long strike for the workers in the Mid-Atlantic and then on the West Coast. I guess it's going to be a three-day strike. And the hope is that this is the shock to the system that makes the employer Kaiser Permanente a nonprofit with $4.5 billion profit in the first two quarters of this year, say, hey, you know, maybe we do need to do some things to make care better, to make working conditions better, to make pay and benefit better. Also, one of the things they're also talking about is retiree health care. This is another one of these things that I'm glad to see back. We had fought for it for a while, a couple of generations ago. Something I think needs to be fought for again, because I don't know that we're ever getting to national health care, but maybe this is how we get there and ensure that cradle to grave people are taken care of. But just my thoughts. Let's go to the phones. We've got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane. So I was talking to a MAGA Republican today, and they brought up to me about, it was a neighbor. So they brought up to me that, you know, about McCarthy being removed. And I thought, oh, joy, here we go. And I said, well, you know, I said, there's some crazy lunatics that you've got in the Republican Party. And unfortunately, that minority there is causing you all kind of problems. And they actually agreed with me, and I thought I was going to faint. And then they said, well, I'll tell you one thing. At least you Democrats aren't arguing with each other. And I just hurried up and changed the subject. But I thought, oh, wow, some of the MAGA Republicans are taking note now.
There's common ground.
But I think they, yeah. So I also seen in the Washington Post where they were saying Matt Gaetz wants to be Speaker of the House. And I thought I was going to fall on the floor from laughing so hard.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
I thought, oh, yeah, let's get him in there,
I'm
right?
I'm all in favor of it. No, let's bring on the crazy. Bring Trump. Maybe you can have a co-thing. Maybe Gaetz and Trump. You know, maybe co-speakers. Because, look, they're not going to get anything done. They don't have an agenda. They don't have policy initiatives that are passable. They've got hardline insanity that is never going to pass. They've got messaging bills that are all about cruelty and hatred, and they're getting exactly what they deserve.
Well, that's true, but I think they do have an agenda, Rick, and the agenda that they have is to cause as much chaos and destruction and misery as they can.
Yeah,
well, I think that is their agenda.
Mission accomplished.
Exactly. But have a good evening.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. No, I'm coming around to the reality that Republicans don't want to be in the majority, or at least the House Republicans. Because look, you know, I've known a lot of people who've been in Congress, and to do it right, to actually do the job, It's a lot of work, and it's not glamorous. It's not, you know, it's not all, you know, TV interviews and pats on the back and ribbon cuttings. It's a lot of research. It's a lot of reading, These bills are not short. And I know you had the Herman Cains of the world. You know, every piece of legislation I pass is going to be 2 pages long so that you can read it at the dinner table. You go, yeah, you're going to 2 pages, huh? You think you're going to be able to do, yeah, I'm going to do health care reform in 2 pages. Yeah. Again, shows how little they understand on what it takes to govern. This is one of those places where I want smart people. I want smart people who are going to do good things and want to do good things. This is the part that's just remarkable to me. You have, you know, you can go through the list of the Republicans who are usually on the podcast circuit or on the F channel or any of the other right-wing cable outlets. It's all about, hey, look at me. It's all about how can I get that next gig. It's not about making your life better. It's not about making the lives of working people better. And this is where, you know, I've said this before, this is my true north. How do we make the person who gets up every day, punches that clock, does what's asked of them? How do we make their lives better? How do we get more money into their paychecks? How do we get better health and retirement security into their lives, better education for their children? How do we do, you know, go down the list, better infrastructure so it doesn't take them so long to get to work, you know, maybe public transit. There are 1,000 things we could be doing, but we're not. You know what we're doing? We're throwing Nancy Pelosi out of her office. Because that's the best they could come up with. That's it. I mean, wow. I mean, if you really wanted to play the reality TV game, couldn't you come up with something more creative? And the answer is no, because it's not about that. It's about dysfunction. And I hope the American people in 13 months go to the polls and throw these people into the minority. I'd love to see all of them go because they're not serious legislators. These are not serious people who care about the American people. They're not. These are people. These are chaos merchants. These are outrage merchants. But Rick, it's not all of them. You know, I used to believe you're right. It's not all of them. But the fact that there doesn't seem to be any room for movement. The fact that they have no ideas and no will to make lives better. I'm just not there anymore. They've lost me on that. You know, it's not all of them. You're now guilty by association. As my mother always said, you're judged by the friends you hang out with. You know, those bums you hang out with that were causing trouble. Well, you're one of them. Well, you got that R behind your name. You're one of them. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, the tweet of the day comes from Rick Wilson. The Rick Wilson said, stop asking if 1930s Germany can happen here. It's happening here. And look, he's absolutely right. And it's been happening for a while. Not surprising. And I blame our media. I've been saying this for a long time. I know it's easy, cheap shot, but I blame our corporate controlled media for, you know, doing this whole both sides thing as I'm always being, well, you know, we've got to tell the other side. For instance, Washington Post, we talked about this yesterday, still reporting that the fraud trial, still reporting that it's alleged. No, the judge said he's guilty of fraud. That's the reality. There was a summary judgment. The bench trial, it happened. It's no longer alleged. Stop. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the both sides-ism. And are we living? Is it happening? Is 1930s Germany happening right before our very eyes? That's why I've asked my good friend Will Bunch to come talk with us. Will is a national columnist over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's also the author of the fabulous book, After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Hey, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So this frame, people have been talking about for a little bit about this both sides-ism. You've got the Republicans saying, you know, one thing, you got Democrats saying another. One side's telling something close to reality. One just kind of making stuff up, not even close to reality, but yet got to report them as their equal.
Yeah. I mean, we saw a crazy example of that just in the last couple of days with this total meltdown that's happening up on Capitol Hill, right? And, you get these mainstream papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times writing pieces that basically say, you know, why is Congress so dysfunctional? Or, you know, why can't Congress pass a budget bill? Or, McCarthy gets ousted and it's like, Congress is totally broken. It's like, no, I mean, Congress isn't broken. I mean, the Democrats in Congress seem to be doing just fine. It's one party that's totally broken.
Yep.
And you know, all these things that we're talking about, they're also interrelated. This dysfunctional Congress, which is totally the fault of Republicans, that's one of the things that's enabling this brand of fascism that we're seeing now, because they want to gin up cynicism, right? They want voters to think the system is so badly broken that, you know, that only a strong man can fix it.
Yeah.
That, look, democracy, you know, this is what they say, that, look, democracy is not working anymore. So we need to try something else.
Will, I've been saying for years, Republicans run on government shouldn't do anything, can't do anything, government's broken. And then when they get in there, they set out to break it. Now they've just completely broken it. I think they've gone a bit too far in breaking things to where I'm hoping, and maybe you'll agree or disagree, I'm hoping the American people are paying attention, because we are absolutely in uncharted waters right now. This has not happened before in our country, and a lot of firsts seem to be happening with Republican leadership right now. And I'm hoping voters are paying attention, because we're 13 months away from the next election.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually working on a column right now. It's not going to be published until tomorrow, unfortunately, but it really touches on a lot of the things that we're talking about here. And this is fascinating. And so far, only The Guardian, which not enough Americans probably read, it's a very good publication, but only The Guardian has done a story about this. But, you know, these far right think tanks, I know that's kind of an oxymoron to talk about the far right and thinking, right? But, these groups like the Claremont Institute and Hillsdale College, which are, you know, these groups that have been created to come up with this kind of pseudo intellectual heft behind, you know, Trumpism and the authoritarian drift of the Republican Party. They in the last like 6 months or so, you know, these these pseudo intellectuals on the right have been writing pieces saying that we America needs what they call a red Caesar. I guess red being for Republican, right? A Caesar, you know, that like in ancient Rome, you know, to argue that democracy is not working and we need somebody to come in and assume dictatorial powers, you know. And it's like, oh, just, you know, just temporarily, just to, you know, just to get the Marxists or whatever they're calling people these days out of the deep state, you know, just to break down the influence of all these liberals who've taken over these agencies and these systems, you know. And that's their plan, you know. I mean, they have this blueprint called Project 2025. I don't know if you guys have talked about
The Heritage Foundation.
And you know, it's basically to, you know, and civil service,
it's to bring back patronage is what it is.
And put Trumpists in every, you know, over EPA and the NLRB and any other important agency that you can think of, but destroy them. You know, it's one thing, you know, this isn't Ronald Reagan putting Gorsuch's mom in the EPA and siding with polluters. This is destroying the EPA. This is like breaking these agencies beyond recognition.
But here's the thing, and we've talked about this, you know, over the last several years. You know, right now, ALEC is celebrating its 50th anniversary. None of this stuff is new. The Heritage Foundation is over 50 years old. They created this massive state policy network of think tanks, or, you know, stink tanks, or whatever you want to call them. In every state, they've got chaos merchants coming up with their own alternative reality, their own alternative facts. And as I've been saying here, Republicans right now are lying differently. They're lying much differently than past generations because they're creating their own reality out of these groups that you're talking about. All of these state policy networks, all of the folks that you talked about, they're creating out of whole cloth. They're just pulling stuff out of, you know, out of whichever orifice they can grab it out of. And that now becomes the talking point. Whereas in the past, at least there were decent, honest people on that side of the aisle who said, no, that's too far. Now it seems like they're all on board.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mitt Romney, who is the last of arguably of one of those type people, is, you know, it's like he's had enough. I mean, the last few people who maybe, you know, I mean, John McCain is long gone, and I'm not huge fans of those people and their politics, but at least you're right. At least there was a level of honesty. You know, I think it's interesting. I was thinking when you were saying about how a lot of these practices have been going on for some time, and it's just like it seems like it's getting worse. I mean, you know, I think you're right. And I think what's happened, though, is I think that, you know, starting, you know, going back to the 60s, you know, when the culture wars really kicked off, and also, you know, when you had the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, and you had you had Title IX empowering women, right? You had all of these things. And you know, the initial reaction is, we can beat this through politics, right? You know, they had Ronald Reagan, who was a master politician, and, you know, and they were able to win elections. You know, they won the 88 election with the Willie Horton ad and these other scare tactics against Black people. And it was ugly and it was horrible, but they could win elections. And as you know, I mean, since 1988, you know, Republicans have lost the popular vote in seven out of the last eight presidential elections.
Because their policies are bad. This is important. Their policies are horrible. The American people realize that their pro-corporate, pro-rich people, you know, anti-worker agenda is horrible for the mass of the people. So, yes, they're going to lose the popular vote, which is why they've had to go full on, you know, alternative reality, alternative facts, fear, scare, and shame people.
Yeah, I mean, what this movement is, what conservatism in this country is all about is preserving the hierarchies, right? Preserving the hierarchy of, you know, white supremacy or white privilege or whatever you want to call it, you know, preserving the patriarchy, you know, where men are dominant, and they're going to do that to to borrow a phrase of Malcolm X, they're going to do that by any means necessary, right? And if elections can't do it, they're going to find some other way. And, you know, I mean, they went from, you know, winning elections with, you know, Willie Horton type ads to, you know, voter suppression, voter ID laws, things to suppress the vote. And now even that's not enough. So that's why, you know, you see, if we can somehow get, you know, if we can somehow get Trump in there in 2025, we're just going to throw it all out. We're just going to make him become a red Caesar, you know, have him seize, you know, they won't call it dictatorial powers. I don't know what they're going to call it, but that's what it's going to be. It's going to be dictatorial powers. And you know, and just real quickly, I mean, this is why what we were initially talking about, what you were initially talking about, the both sides problem in the media, this is why that is so important, because that reality is not coming across to the average voter, I don't think.
No, because
it's
where
coming
I was
across
going
to some people. I mean, there's more, you know, like that Rick Wilson tweet that you quoted at the beginning. Yeah, I mean, you're hearing more discourse like that, right? You're hearing more people saying, no, this is really like 1930s fascism was in Europe, you know?
Well, what I was going to say is, you know, you have this want of authoritarianism by folks on the right. And, you know, I look at that story coming out of Staten Island of all those people in Staten Island, you know, doing all kinds of outrageous stuff to people who have been moved there from Texas or Florida or wherever, you know, playing music at all hours of the night, harassing the refugees and all of this stuff, just being horrible human beings.
It's horrible. You know, I've just noticed. I've just seen really recently, like in the last few months, just a huge uptick in this type of behavior. And let me give you another example. You know, we had a guy who was a freelance journalist and kind of an activist here in Philadelphia, a guy named Josh Kruger, who was formerly homeless, overcame drug addiction. And he wrote about these issues, and he was a real kind of civic mensch, civic asset. And, you know, he was murdered this week. And, you know, a lot of us who knew him, I mean, I knew him on social media mainly, but those of us who knew him, you know, posted, you know, were shocked, what a loss. And these posts on social media were flooded with haters saying, good riddance, you know, one less journalist, thank God this guy was killed. And that happened, apparently a liberal activist was murdered in a street crime up in New York City a few days ago, and the same thing happened, where you've got these like swarms of online fascists, basically, maybe some of them are coming from Russia or somewhere else. Maybe they're not even all Americans, but, you know, and the Staten Island thing, I was just reading about that today. It's another side of that same coin. It's just this ugliness out there. And
no, see, I've been saying for a while, social media has allowed people to be the worst versions of themselves. And I think Trump and the Republican Party have, you know, because online is one thing, but out in public is another, and dealing with each other is another. And I think Trump and the Republican Party have given people I'm not going to say the permission, but have allowed the idea that you can be the worst version of yourself, not just online, but to people's face. And this is where I fear that this hype, this tension is going to continue to rise to a point where possibly there may be violence at some point down the road.
Yeah. Well, remember when Trump first came on the scene, when he ran the first time in 2015 and 2016, and all those people at his rallies saying, you know, I love this guy, he tells it like it is. And it's like, well, no, he was just saying the racism and xenophobia and other things that they wanted to say. Yeah. And he was saying it. And at some point it's like, yeah, if he's saying it, then we can say it too, you know? And I think you've seen this devolve, you know, over the last 8 years. And,
yeah. I mean, I look at Twitter, Twitter's become a cesspool.
And yeah. And Elon Musk, the owner, for whatever reason, is enabling this. And
no, I think he bought, I said the day he bought it, he has bought Twitter to destroy it, And look, there was just an article out the other day that has proved me right. He, you know, he's going from the playbook that was given to him when he bought Twitter to destroy it, because you can't have a platform where people actually get news and information. And I'm sure you saw today that they're ending the headlines on articles that are being shared, because I guess they don't ever want you to leave that cesspool of a platform.
Yeah, which, you know, takes away one of the original things that people really liked about Twitter back in the pre-Elon Musk era, which was, you know, going on there to find out what was going on. People would post links to articles that you hadn't seen. And, you know, it still works sometime. That whole Red Caesar thing in The Guardian, I wouldn't have seen that if somebody hadn't linked to it on Twitter, right? So, but, you know, they're trying to take that away. And it is amazing. And it's like, you know, I mean, is it really that simple that it's just that Elon Musk is this billionaire who doesn't want to get taxed, doesn't want a government that is anti-billionaire, anti-wealth, and he's willing to, you know, he realized that Twitter was a threat to that, right? You know, if Twitter operated the way it could operate.
Yeah. Last question I've got for you, because, you know, we're in this situation. The media, I think, was a big part of getting us here. This whole both sidesism thing, and I love the one statement I saw. You know, should the media give equal weight to both sides, even when one of them is lying? And the fact that someone would even ask that question is just incredible to me. But that's kind of the world we're in. So if they got us into this, do you have any hope that they get us out?
I don't know. You know, the people who are running the big organizations, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post, which are so influential, both have fairly recent new editors, and they both, you know, and I, the Wall Street Journal, I believe also, which I think it was the editor of the Wall Street Journal who made that comment that you were just quoting. And, you know, these people are all new, and they are all wedded to the both sides philosophy. And, you know, I've been in journalism for, I lost track, well over 40 years, 42 or 43 years now. And so I know the mentality, and I understand where it comes from. And it was born in a different era. And, you know, when I was a young journalist, I bought into it, I applauded it. And then I saw things that actually happened in the real world, like the bogus Iraq war in 2003, for example. And I came to realize that, you know, the flaws of both sides, journalism, that it doesn't work. And the situation we're in now is, you know, a five alarm situation, because, you know, journalism and democracy are just intertwined. You know, you can't be a journalist and be neutral about democracy, because, you know, we see around the world in the more established dictatorships, you know, we see what happens to journalists. You know, we see, look at what happens.
They throw
to
them
journalists
out of planes.
Yeah. Look at Vladimir Putin's Russia, where, you know, journalists, if they're not banned, they're being tossed out of windows. Right. You know? And so you can't be neutral about that. And I don't think the public is getting enough information about the, anti-democratic threat that we're facing right now.
I'm right there with you.
I don't.
Will, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Keep up the great work. I hope folks will check out the book, also the column. We'll get links out on social media how folks can do that. But Will, I appreciate the time.
Yeah, Rick, thanks for having me. I appreciate it as well. Good to talk to you.
Good stuff, our good friend Will Bunch. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the evening that a series of explosions began at the T.A. Gillespie Company near Morgan, New Jersey. The explosions would destroy the plant and 300 buildings and kill an estimated 100 people. The world was embroiled in World War I. The United States had entered the global conflict the year before. The nation's factories were churning out munitions and other supplies for the war effort. On that fateful evening at Gillespie, workers were loading shells at the sprawling complex of 700 buildings that covered more than 2,000 acres. The initial explosion was likely an accident. Regardless, the explosion was so severe that it cut water lines to that part of the plant. Without water pressure, firefighters struggled to douse the flames. A chain reaction of explosions touched off as the fire spread in the plant. Houses in the nearby town shook from the massive explosions. Windows exploded and residents fled. Residents from three towns were evacuated due to the disaster. The New York Sun described the exodus as, quote, streams of human misery, mothers and fathers, frightened children clutching still more frightened dogs, old people tottering along with all the same dazed expressions on their faces, as if they scarcely realized what had happened. When the fire was finally put out, nearly half of the plant's buildings were destroyed. It was impossible to say exactly how many workers were killed, so bad was the carnage. Two members of the U.S. Coast Guard died responding to the disaster. The disaster was then compounded when a flu epidemic swept through the residents evacuated from nearby towns. The death toll and misery from these tragic events mounted even higher.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Again, I go back to the frame. Republicans lie differently today. You know, back in the old days, there was at least a kernel of truth. Now, well, they're just, as Kellyanne Conway said, they've got their alternative facts. You know which orifice they pulled those out of. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Steve on line one from Chicago. Steve, how are you?
Yes, I'm fine. And I wanted to chime in on the discussion you were having with the previous guest. I caught the tail end of that. And when it comes to looking at the scholarship on why societies disintegrate, we actually find that it's because of distrust in the courts, distrust in terms of lawmakers, distrust in terms of journalism. All of the institutions that you rely upon in a democracy, a functional democracy, when those cease to function, a society can disintegrate. And that's why it's essential that we have these institutions and that they are functional. And unfortunately, trust, when you ask Americans, it's at record lows when it comes to media. It's at record lows when it comes to the legislature and also the presidency. Now, obviously, Donald Trump contributed to that with regard to the executive office. Low trust in terms of the House and the Senate. Well, that's been something that's been going on for a couple of decades. But now we've introduced a dangerous third element, and that is the extremely low trust that exists in the highest court in the land. Because there was a time in America when pretty much we could rely on the high court to be an objective arbiter of what goes on in our democracy. But no longer. Now the feeling among many Americans is that basically it's just another element in the lawmaking process that can be bought and sold by the wealthy. And that's a problem. Again, if we want this society to survive in terms of its function as a constitutional republic, those institutions need to be maintained and strengthened. And this idea that we can just simply sit by and watch as they deteriorate without any impact is just naive.
Yeah. What do you make of the argument that Will was making about, you know, that the right is possibly going to be pushing for a red Caesar, an authoritarian to come in and say, I can fix a Donald Trump, say, I alone can fix all of those problems? Because you're right. Congress is, you know, I think syphilis was more had a higher approval rating than Congress. As you said, the Supreme Court struggling, the executive branch is struggling, you know, all of this stuff. You know, what do you make of that? Do you think that's something Americans would tolerate?
Well, you know, like a lot of people, I thought, with the Cold War having come to an end, that, you know, the book, The End of History, you know, basically articulated what a lot of us thought, that, you know, okay, the last great conflict had been resolved, and that liberal Western democracy was the order of the day moving forward. And this idea of, you know, a strong man rule and the desire to see someone like a Stalin or a Hitler or other sorts of figures such as this, that was something that we had outgrown. Well, you know, the human beings are now more sophisticated. No, it turns out that we're not. There are some of us that are, but there are other people who just want to be led by the nose and are willing to listen to whomever tells them what they want to hear. And that's what Donald Trump did in 2016. He basically told a bunch of people who didn't know any better that, yeah, I'll get you back your grandfather's coal mining job, as if somebody actually wanted that or that was possible. Hillary Clinton refused to tell the lie, but Donald Trump decided to lie to people as if that was something that could happen, given the fact that those jobs are not overseas, as he claimed. They're taken over by automation,
right.
You know, and so they're not coming back. And when people don't care about facts, they just care about the savior. So in the same way that Adolf Hitler promised to save Germany, Donald Trump took it from his playbook and other fascist playbooks.
Yep, you know, you're spot on, Steve.
These are the people who are to blame. They don't look like you. They have different religions. Their complexion is different. And
I agree.
Let me save us.
Gotta go. Steve, appreciate the thoughts. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today marks the 50th anniversary, and I don't want to mark this positively, because this has been horribly destructive for democracy, horribly destructive for working people. You know, every bit of the No Rights at Work agenda comes out of this one organization. They're called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, brought up back in the 70s. It's one of those things that sprung out of the Heritage Foundation, you know, big money, you know, rich people going, hey, how do we save free enterprise, you know, from those unions and those workers and those people? Well, they created these institutions who come up with bad ideas. And every bad idea that's harmed working people, ALEC has been behind. So here to mark 50 years of harm, I've asked Vicki Harrison to come talk with us. Vicki is the Director of Constitutional Convention and Protecting Dissent Programs at our good friends at Common Cause. Vicki, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.
50 years of harm. I mean, I can't even wrap my mind around how much damage this organization has done over 50 years. And for the vast majority of those 50 years, nobody knew who they were. This has just been the last 10 or 15 years that people actually get an idea of who they are and how bad they are.
They're awful. And you're absolutely right, Rick. ALEC started 50 years ago. They celebrated their 50th anniversary in D.C. tonight with a gala at the National Portrait Gallery. And what ALEC has been doing for 50 years is creating really bad model policy laws that large corporations, big money donors, are pushing through. And then they meet with state legislators who then take these bad policies back to their states, pretend like it's something they came up with to help their community. And not only is it allowing these companies to make money, because there's a fiscal aspect to a lot of the bills. I mean, why else are you going to try to pass a bill? Why are you going to spend money? But they are serious threats to workers, our environment, racial justice, the vitality of our democracy. I say your listeners can think of any bad bill that has passed for the common good in the last 50 years, and it will have ALEC's fingerprints on it.
Yeah, give me a couple of examples. You know, here in my state of Pennsylvania, they were behind a bad, horrible, horrible unemployment destruction bill. They've been behind a lot of the destruction of prevailing wage laws. They've been, you name it, they've been behind it. But give us some examples so that maybe people have a tangible idea of what we're talking about.
Okay, so Rick, let's start with for workers. I mean, the big one, right to work. I mean, that is a model ALEC bill that they have pushed in nearly half of our states now. We've got this thing called the Paycheck Protection Act, which, again, many unions permit dues to be directly deducted from the paychecks, just the way insurance premiums are withheld. This model legislation would prohibit that.
Yeah, I love that name, though. I love that name.
The all of them are protection. Like that, Rick.
I love the messaging behind it, though, because it's so not what it is. Because wage theft is still perfectly okay. They're not fighting against wage theft. In fact, you know, they're promoting, you know, committing wage theft. But paycheck protection is protecting you from, well, from your union fighting for better wages, hours, and conditions. It's really brilliant if you think about it.
Well, they do that all over the place. I mean, when we want to talk about, you know, protecting big polluters, they have the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act. Okay, wow. We want to make sure that our infrastructure is safe. No, that bill calls for increased penalties for civil disobedience. It says that if you're protesting at a pipeline or anything that has an interest for fossil fuels, you can have felony charges. You can have fines. You can go to prison. And they, you know, voter ID laws, they've tried to distance themselves from that. The Stand Your Ground law, you know, I tell people that was not an original ALEC bill. But once Florida passed that bill, they're like, hey, let's jump on this. And then they spread it to 22 other states. Whether we're talking about the environment, whether we're talking about stopping the right to protest, which is in the First Amendment, workers' rights, local democracy, you know, doing everything they can to make sure that local governments can't pass laws. You know, this whole preemption idea that everything should be done at the state level and God forbid a city council pass a bill that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, what's amazing to me is, yeah, I remember the first time I learned about ALEC, because there were some really bad unemployment insurance bills popping up, and they all seemed to look alike. They all had the same ideas, the same verbiage. They all followed the same flow. It was remarkable how multiple legislators could have the identical same piece of. In fact, my congressman Scott Perry at the time was one of the people who turned in someone else's homework, I believe. Because I had actually asked him about it back then. And that's when I really found out about ALEC. And then, you know, basically just handing out model legislation that legislators across the country would then turn in as their own homework, hoping no one would notice.
Hoping no one would notice. And again, they're passing these bills so the sponsors, the corporations who are on these task force creating this model legislation with state legislators who then vote on it at these conferences, they are monetarily benefiting from many of these bills. And that is what is so frustrating for me, Rick, because, you know, at Common Cause, look, I love me a model bill, okay? I mean, there is nothing wrong with a model bill on same-day registration or how to do early voting the right way or how to not gerrymander my state. We have model bills. We lobby for them. We are proud to lobby for them. But what we do that ALEC doesn't do is we register to lobby. We report our lobbying activities. We use C4 money for that. Whereas they continue to say they don't do any lobbying, they just educate. So therefore they don't have to follow any lobby rules. And then the final thing is at Common Cause, we don't monetarily benefit when people stop gerrymandering their state. And that is what is so frustrating about ALEC. Not only are there bills that they are passing horrible for the American people, they're also just blowing through all the rules that the rest of us are following.
Now, you said that they just educate. Where do they do this education? You know, when legislators this education, where does this education generally happen?
Well, it's usually in a beach town, I will say that. There's a lot of cigar bars thrown in and whiskey nights, and they have resorts. And, you know, what used to happen, so you had mentioned this earlier, how we didn't know anything about ALEC for many years, and 10, 15 years ago. Well, there was a whistleblower that went to Lisa Graves at the Center for Media and Democracy and dumped nearly 1,000 model bills. And if your listeners have not watched Bill Moyer's United States of ALEC from a decade ago, I highly suggest it. It is very informative. And that was the first time we in this community, Center is one of my partners, and that we ever knew how big they reached and how much they worked on. And so what they used to do was they had corporations spend a bunch of money, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to be a member, and a legislator would pay $100 for a 2-year membership. So corporations were right there. The lobbyists for the corporations are hanging out at these resorts with legislators from around the country. Well, once we found out their breadth of it, we and many partners pushed all these corporations to leave ALEC. And to date, we've had about 125 of them leave ALEC. And instead of having those corporate memberships, they're now getting sketchy, Rick. They're just having people, you know, sponsor an event or be a contributor or sit on a board. In fact, we just got released this week, all of their sponsors and committee members and host for their big event they held tonight. And again, very surprising. We and our partners are starting a petition tomorrow to once again dump ALEC. And we are going to be asking everybody who is listed in any invitation tonight, not only their presidents and CEOs, but their entire board of directors, will find out about them spending money at ALEC and that it's not appropriate.
No, I'm right there with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Vicki Harrison. Vicki is the Director of Constitutional Convention and Protecting Dissent Programs at Common Cause, commoncause.org, the website if you want to check out the work that they do. If you want to know more about ALEC, alecexposed.org is the website. We'll get links on social media on both of those so you can check out all of that stuff. Now, what's interesting is right now we're now seeing, you know, all of these groups that have been around for decades that have been doing back, you know, back alley, back room, you know, smoky back room work. You've got ALEC, you've got the Heritage Foundation, the State Policy Network, Federalist Society. You've got all of these big money groups doing the work of the billionaire class and the wealth class in corporate America. And I don't know that the working class of this country, that working people, quite get how intertwined these moneyed interests are. And it does, for me, explain why when we want to get something like an increase in the minimum wage, which hasn't happened in, 14 years now, it doesn't happen. Why when we want to make sure that we protect unemployment insurance or workers' comp or whatever, it doesn't seem to happen. What we want and need doesn't seem to get done, but what corporate America and our billionaire class wants, they're on it in a heartbeat. This kind of explains it, doesn't it?
It absolutely explains it. And everybody you just mentioned is, of course, a sponsor for the gala that they held tonight. You've got State Policy Network on there. You've got the Heritage Foundation. You've got, you know, Prosperity. You've got them all on there. And again, people don't spend money and decades of work expecting nothing in return.
No, as my grandfather always said, if a rich guy takes a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because he understands return on investment. And these people do. And what's amazing to me, Vicki, is how cheap, how little they spend to get so much. I mean, that's the part that's just really offensive to me.
It's very offensive. And, you know, it's even more insidious because they continue to insist that they're only doing outreach and education and not lobbying. So all the legislators who go to their junkets, do they even have to report that under their lobbying laws, under their financial disclosures? I mean, again, these are people that want regular Americans out of the process, period. And, you know, in fact, when ALEC was founded, the same guy who founded the Heritage Foundation, Paul Weyrich, I mean, we've all heard this quote of his that we don't want people to vote. And if, in case your folks have not heard it, he literally said, I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of the people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And what's interesting about that quote, is he's talking to 20,000 Baptist ministers. So you're taking this kind of fascistic, kind of financial dominance and putting it with religion and telling religious leaders this stuff. And again, you know, 1980 was a long time ago, but not for this message. This is how we got here. It's how we got where we are now.
That's how we got here. And again, the prior to that quote in that speech, you know, he makes fun of good government. You know, he calls it the goo-goo. There's too many of y'all out there trying to do what I call the goo-goo, good government. And I just think, you know, as an organization that is founded after Watergate for good government and holding power accountable, it's just offensive to have these guys in what they think are behind their closed doors, saying all the quiet stuff really, really loud.
Yeah, they don't care anymore because it's almost okay now because we've allowed for obscene wealth. Whereas, you know, back then you still had a high top marginal tax rate. We were still kind of taxing people at a higher rate.
It was still a middle class.
And you still had a middle class of working people who were saying, hey, we don't want an Elon Musk or a Jeff Bezos. We don't want the kind of obscene wealth that would allow for this kind of stuff. So your last line of questioning, you know, with this anniversary, you know, and I don't want to mark this positively, what should average everyday working people be doing? How do we combat the kind of damage that they do? You know, what's your hope moving forward?
My hope is always, Rick, that everybody will talk to their legislators, your state senator and your state representative, and let them know this is what is happening. Get involved with any of the organizations, whether it's, you know, labor, Greenpeace, Common Cause, People for the American Way, Union of Concerned Scientists, Center for Media and Democracy. There are dozens of us that are working to stop these harmful policies. And the only reason a lot of times they get through is because nobody knows. They want the secrecy, which is why, you know, I wanted our hashtag to be, you know, like a fence. I wanted to be like, I'm watching your little so-and-so, okay? We are not stopping. We are paying attention to you. And that's what your listeners can do. Reach out. Think whatever issue is important to you, put that issue in your browser and then put ALEC, and you will find something. You will find an organization that is actively trying to stop them because they're coming for us in the 2024 session, whether it's workers, anti-ESG, stopping the right to boycott. I mean, there is a lot going on. And that's why this week we highlighted all of that. We started the week with a showing of a film called Boycott, one of the best documentaries I've seen in a long time. This is a piece of legislation they've been passing where if you want to do business with the state, in your contract, it literally says, I will not boycott Israel. Even if you have nothing to do with Israel. And this is something Alex started pushing. And this film called Boycott from Just Vision is fantastic. It follows three plaintiffs. And today we were talking to the publisher and founder of the Arkansas Times, who lost all of his state contracts for advertising because he refused to sign this. He's like, what do I have to do with Israel? I'm a publisher in Arkansas. And think about that, Rick. They could remove that word Israel and put anything they wanted to in there.
No, that's scary.
And it's already passed in dozens of states.
That is scary. Vicki, I appreciate the time, the information. Good stuff. I hope you'll keep us informed on what's going on. I wish you the best for throughout the action week. Folks want to learn more, alecexposed.org, the website. You want to know more about Common Cause, commoncause.org. Vicki Harrison, appreciate the time.
Thank you so much, Rick. Have a great evening.
You as well. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, I look at Alec, and again, you know, this is not new. You know, none of this stuff is surprising. None of it's new. We know who Alec is. We know what they do. And a lot of this comes down to you've got a lot of very, very wealthy people who want to make more. They want more power. They want more control. They want more. That's it. More. It's that simple. Just more. And we as working people never seem to get the things that we need. They get everything they want. We don't seem to get the things that we need. And that's, you know, that's angering to me on a whole bunch of levels. But, you know, here's the thing that gets me. You know, I was saying earlier that, you know, Republicans just seem to lie a little differently these days. You know, in the old days, there had to be at least some kernel of truth, some bit of reality, something. There had to be something there. And I came across this clip of an Ohio State representative. Her name is Beth Lear, a Republican in the state of Ohio, in the state house there. She's the co-author of a anti-trans bathroom bill. And it's look, we can debate over that if we have to. But it's this kind of stuff that is kind of is completely outrageous. She's I'm just gonna play what she had to say, because it really is quite. This is one of those moments. It reminds me of the when we went to Iraq the first time, and you got the candy striper, who said, you know, she was in Kuwait, and she was a candy striper, and the Iraqi soldiers were throwing babies out of incubators and bayoneting them on the ground, and, you know, the whole country was outraged. But eventually we found out it was total bunk. It was complete BS. This kind of stuff. Here's the representative. Listen to this.
I happen to know a young lady who was tragically raped by multiple members of an athletic team, and because of that, she decided to transition. She was not allowed to consider, because our mental health situation doesn't allow it, but that's not for this bill. She was not allowed to consider the tragedy that was that rape. What she was encouraged to do was, if you're uncomfortable in your body, you should change it. And she's gone through with transition because she's afraid of men.
She's afraid of men. Now, here's the problem. That's a horrible story. Oh my God. You know, someone, you know, brutally raped and all the horrible story. Problem is, there is not one shred of evidence that it ever took place. This is the kind of stuff that gets me. We're just now making stuff up. It's alternative facts, alternative reality, because there's got to be somebody out there, right? Something like this had to happen somewhere in a country of 325 million people, right? And, you know, I'm watching the video and I'm looking at the guy standing next to her, and the guy standing next to her is kind of like going, "What are you talking about?" The look on his face is like, "Oh my God, why am I standing here? I am now going to be part of this picture of, are you kidding me?" That's the way it looked. But here's the part that I'm struggling with, because again, the alternative reality. You know, there was somehow in a bathroom raped by, you know, multiple people. I think I'm supposed to believe that it was, you know, people who were, you know, maybe trans. I'm not sure, because it's a trans bathroom bill, so it's kind of, I think that's what it's supposed to be. But it was, I guess, I don't even know. And are there multiple people who are in this? Because she said multiple times. And then the kicker was, she was forcibly transitioned. She then forcibly trans. You go, what? Wait, forcibly? Someone made her? And this plays into all of the right-wing lunacy that there's all of this stuff going on, that, you know, all of these people are, you know, are transitioning and they're raping people in bathrooms, happening everywhere. And then, you know, they're going to make you transition, which is crazy. But it's the alternative reality that they're selling. It's the alternative facts that they keep throwing out. And again, like I've been saying, Republicans just seem to lie a little differently than they used to. They lied a lot before, but at least it was, I don't know, something close to reality. I don't know, somewhere in the neighborhood of reality. Now we're just making you know what up. I want to hear your thoughts. What do you think of that? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the things we talk about quite often on the program is, conditions at work. For years, I've talked about a friend of mine who's blind and the struggles that he has getting a job, even though I got to tell you, the guy's Superman. He can fix anything. In fact, you know, whenever I need something mechanical, I need information, I just call him. And he literally walks me through every step of the process. And you know, he's blind. He cannot see anything, but he tore my engine apart, put it back together. This is a guy who has incredible skills, but a lot of employers not even going to give him a chance. I'm here to share some thoughts on, you know, maybe how we change some of that, how we address some of that. I've asked Julie Metro to come talk with us. She's a fellow over at Mother Jones. She's got an article out right now for disabled workers. Discrimination is common if you even get to apply. Julia, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, so October is National Disability Employment Awareness Month. Awareness is great, but when we look at data, blind people and other people with disabilities are employed at much lower rates than people without disabilities. And that is extremely frustrating, considering there has been legislation which ideally should have prevented this that are decades old. I should say the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 and the American with Disabilities Act of 1990. So what is the problem? What I think and what some other people think is that there are systemic ableism issues with hiring, and for blind people, how that can show up is corporations not testing their hiring portals. So for example, on Workday or Greenhouse, if they have something where something needs to be uploaded, they don't check to make sure that a screen reader, which is a device that reads text and also automation, for example, telling you to upload your resume aloud, when it's not checked and that's not being part of the system, that can lead to issues that blind people face with applying.
Now, in your story, you actually talk about someone who went blind later in life, mm-hmm. but actually wrote programs that he then tried to use and couldn't access the things that even he wrote after he went blind, which I found kind of interesting.
Yeah. So Marco, one of the persons I had talked to, he had worked at a very successful a startup in San Francisco. They said there was a full-time position open. He set out to apply. He went to the job description, which he also helped write, which is why it's so infuriating. And then he went to kind of the next step, and it was the section where you upload a resume. His screen reader could not tell what was there because the kind of like the functions in the background didn't have the right cue. So he had to get his wife to help him. And why that is a problem is that blind people and other people with disabilities deserve autonomy. Blind people can work on their own, but that means companies' software and their websites and all that need to follow guidelines set out by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is actually not that complicated. And also, there are a lot of places such that I highlighted in my article, like Job Accommodation Network, where you can access resources for free.
So what's the way forward in this? Because look, I think most people believe if you can do the job, you should be able to get the job. Mm-hmm. And if there are reasonable accommodations that can be made, that, you know, that's part of this. And like I said, you know, my friend is highly capable. But, you know, as you've pointed out, the hiring process, not friendly to him. How can we fix that? How can we make it easier? Is there a path forward, do you think?
Yeah, there's absolutely a path forward. And I think also, like, we're so much more online than so many years ago. Maybe not everyone is like a tech genius, but individually corporations really need to learn best practices, and all companies can test their hiring listings with software, with screen readers, just to make sure it works. And that is a fairly easy thing to do. This shouldn't fall on blind people and other people with low vision. They really just can do better and just test. And then, yeah, and there's so many places, like I mentioned, Job Accommodation Network, which provides a lot of resources. And there's basically an endless amount of places where people can reach out for help if they don't know the best practices.
Now, you talked about two pieces of legislation, one passed in the 70s, one passed in the 90s, mm-hmm. that were supposed to address these issues. Why have they not lived up to expectations? I don't want to say they failed, but maybe that's the question. Have they failed?
The issues are with both the Rehabilitation Act and the ADA, which have been life-changing legislations, is that enforcement of them is kind of frustrating. You can file a complaint with the EEOC, but a lot of these recourses, for example, if you're like an early career blind person, filing a complaint against a company, unfortunately, could lead to you not being hired or retaliation. Again, very illegal, but that can happen. And suing. The issue is enforcement, even with filing an EEOC complaint, can take too long. I think it really should fall on companies. Like, there's no excuse with companies who are huge and have like a major HR department to not do better. And that should really fall on them.
So are you specifically looking at just big companies? You know, because, you know, most employers are smaller, you know, mom and pops, we're told. Small business, mm-hmm. I'm told, is the driver of our economy. Does this mean that people with disabilities and blind people would be excluded from small businesses, or are we just focusing on big, you know, corporations with huge HR departments who can, mm-hmm. you know, test these websites?
So Title I of ADA, which points to employment, I think I'm getting this right. It's for companies with 15 people or more. Whether or not you categorize them as mom and pop, they're definitely not the size of Amazon. They have to follow these regulations. And I think the good thing about, even if you don't have the resources to pay for an external consultant, there are a lot of free online softwares where it could be just watching a video to learn more, which can make a huge difference with how you treat not only blind people, but other disabled employees and other perspectives.
So it sounds to me, and maybe this is just a difference in our way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me that you're looking for a corporate solution, whereas I would look for a more regulatory solution to where, you know, government mm-hmm. would be a partner in this and saying, look, you know, we're going to make sure that these things are tested and are mandated to be functional so that people at least have a shot instead of just the benevolence and goodwill of corporate boards and CEOs. Mm-hmm. I tend to be a little less, I tend to put a lot of less faith in corporate benevolence.
Yeah, no, that's totally understandable. And I think one issue when it comes to this not being addressed in the government too, is that there are not a lot of openly disabled and openly blind lawmakers who would lead the change. I will say that the EEOC did release guidelines in late, I think it was late July, on how companies, big and small, should accommodate blind job applicants and employees. So there is some information out there. I guess I might be a little bit jaded just because these laws that were that have been life-changing that I'm pointing to are decades old. It definitely can be a partnership. And at the moment, it is a partnership, but the partnership relies on someone who is discriminated against to put in a complaint or sue. And that is an unfair burden to put on someone who has been discriminated against, which can take years to go through.
No, I know, again, from personal experience, I have a friend who, again, who's been through this. You know, I had, you know, relatives who went through this kind of stuff. They were functional. They wanted jobs. They just couldn't get that. And it's heartbreaking to see someone who is capable, who can be productive, be thrown to the side. So as a society, you know, how do we take this on and how do we move this forward? Because I think most people think like I do. If you're able to do the job, you should be able to get a shot at doing it. If there are reasonable things that can be done to help, we should be getting that, absolutely. Because I believe in work. I believe that there is a therapeutic quality to work. I believe there's self-esteem that comes with that. There's a whole bunch of positives, I think. How do we move there?
I think one part of that is also recognizing that there's quite a few disabled workers who are not openly disabled out of fear of discrimination. I do think some awareness can help. I don't think this should necessarily only fall on disabled workers. I'm not 100% sure how changing laws would necessarily help. I say this out of fear because literally this week, part of the ADA is under debate at the Supreme Court. So where my brain is at is like, okay, we're going to go backwards anyway. So I'm a bit, I hope not.
This is where I was going to take this eventually, because there is a push to take us backwards. We seem to be moving towards an authoritarian kind of rule where, you know, gays and lesbians and people with disabilities and the others will be shunned to the side. This is one of these things where the hope is now's the time to come out and be forceful in this stuff, much more forceful than just asking for benevolence.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I think that there are very easy ways to see this. And I can say it's just like interesting to see mandatory return to work policies, for example, when some people are able to work from home and they're able to work from home well. And we've learned this over the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic, but corporations still required this. And I think a reason why I'm pointing to the corporations want to do better is we know they're lobbying behind the scenes. So I am hoping they change their ways and can work to just be better and not just check off a box. And I definitely think hiring is an important part. And I think that also indicates why hiring disabled people to be part of the job recruitment process is also a very crucial part that companies can individually do. And the wait time for EEOC complaints needs to be expedited tremendously. That's a problem too. It's like, you don't want to wait for years an update.
That's the problem with a lot of our regulatory bodies. They've been so badly defunded and defanged that it's almost not worth, you know, going through the process. I advocate for it, but sometimes, you know, you're right. You know, it could take years to get through, which is crazy. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because I want to leave this in a place where we're moving in the right direction.
Yes.
Because I think everybody should have a chance. Everybody should be a useful part of society and feel part of society. What would you want people doing? What's the activity? What's the action? And what are the marching orders in making this possible?
Yeah, I think one of the big marching orders is for people in hiring and also just in companies in general, just because you don't get an accommodation that someone needs. That's fine, but you still need to accommodate it and trust that, like, for example, you mentioned your blind friend. Your blind friend knows how to move around in the world. Just because you don't have the same experience doesn't mean that someone else doesn't know what's best for them in helping them do their job. And we should really trust and empower disabled and blind people that they know best and hire them and trust them.
Yeah. Do tax credits, do incentives, does the carrot work? I'm a stick guy, but do carrots work? Mm-hmm.
I don't really think so. I think I hope everything does. I'm a bit of a cynic, but partially because the ADA is even older than me. And so I'm like, oh, it's not working. But I hope things move forward. And I think another huge part of that is getting more disabled people in the position to change the law than enforcement to make it better, which is definitely possible.
No, I'm hopeful. I hope people will take a look at your article. For disabled workers, discrimination is common. If you even get to apply, written by Julia Metro. She's a fellow over at Mother Jones. Make sure you check out the website, motherjones.com. Julia, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great piece. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much. I feel really old now because I remember H.W. Bush signing that ADA and thinking what a huge, huge thing that was and what a game changer it could be. Most people just think about it. We put ramps on sidewalks. But it was a major game changer for a lot of people. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. Don't work with people. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day that President Harry S. Truman issued Executive Order 9639. It ordered the U.S. Navy to seize control of more than four dozen oil refineries across the country. As World War II was drawing to a close, workers in many industries were growing increasingly restless. They had seen company owners rake in record profits, and the workers felt they had not received their fair share. This included oil refinery workers. In August, the workers rejected a proposed settlement of their grievances over wages and hours. On September 17th, the CIO Oil Workers Union called for a strike of its 35,000 members. Although the war was ending, Truman knew oil was needed to demobilize and redeploy the troops. He used that as a basis to thwart the workers and the strike. His executive order declared that the war effort will be unduly impeded or delayed by such interruptions. He went on to state, "The Secretary of the Navy is hereby authorized and directed to take possession of the plants and facilities used in the transportation, refining, and processing of petroleum and petroleum products." Telegrams were sent to the refineries declaring that they were now under the control of the U.S. government. A third of the oil refineries in the nation came under this order. This included refineries owned by the giants of the industry, including Gulf, Shell, and Standard Oil. This was not the last time Truman attempted this tactic. He tried similar methods to intervene in labor disputes on the railroads and in the steel mills. Truman was certainly not alone. For more than a century, U.S. presidents have intervened to end strikes. From Grover Cleveland's calling out the army to end the Pullman strike in 1884 to Reagan locking out the Patco workers in 1981. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. So, you may remember I talked about Drew Barrymore. Evidently, she got a talk show. She had it for a couple years. She said, hey, you know what? We're going to start up our talk show, even though the writers are on strike. We're going to do it anyway. And took a lot of heat. You may remember me going on about Drew Barrymore being a scab and not this not being a good idea, something she should probably reconsider. And she did. You know, she reconsidered. She went back on her scabbery. Now that the show is about to start again, the writers, three of them, Chelsea White, Christina Kinnan, and Liz Coe, the three writers of the show who were there prior to the strike, they have turned down an offer to return to the show. And look, I don't blame them. I don't blame them at all. This is one of those things I said back as this was going on. Once you're a scab, it's hard to get that off. You know, and I told the story about, you know, moving in with my grandparents and the guy, you know, catty corner from my grandparents' house who crossed a picket line like 50 years earlier and was completely ostracized from society. I fear for Drew, and I shouldn't say fear. There's a little you deserve. We maybe need to hold some people accountable in this way. But the writers who made her show, they have said, nope, we're going somewhere else. And I think that's good. Good for them. Now you go, well, it's probably because she'd have been a real royal, you know what, if they went back, possibly. Or it's just these women, these writers are standing on principle. We're not going to work for someone who is willing to stab us in the back. We're not going to work for someone who is willing to go around us. And as I said yesterday about strikes, their relationships. At a certain point, those relationships come back together. So you don't want to do too much. You don't want to say the dreaded things or do the cardinal sin that breaks up the relationship. You know, like scabbing. Scabbing is one of those cardinal sins. So, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out with Drew Barrymore. Evidently, they're looking for new writers as we speak. And look, this could be a moment where, really, I believe the reason that she canceled the show during that period of time was nobody was going to come on. A lot of guests were panicked and go, no, don't want that scab stink on me. That's on you, Drew. And I think for a lot of people, me included, the one thing that I will always remember about her is this scab moment. I don't remember the movies. I know she's in a couple, a lot. But this is now going to be probably the thing. It is what it is. Rudy Giuliani says he's not a drunk. Okay. And he's also suing Joe Biden for calling him a Russian pawn, which I got to tell you, I can't wait for the discovery. Because, you know, this is one of those things where you file a lawsuit. You've said you're not a Russian pawn. You have now come out and you've staked a flag in the ground. Biden claimed you are. You're saying you're not. Does this not open the opportunity for the Biden folks or any decent lawyer to now go through all of your life, find out where all of your money came from? Because I know where you're spending it. You're spending it on legal bills, which is why you're suing Biden, hoping you can pay your legal bills. Because, oh, by the way, you lost another lawyer in Georgia. It's gonna be him defending himself. And what's that thing about lawyers defending themselves? Something about having a fool for a client? Yep. There you go. Now, also, Hunter Biden is evidently weighing some fundraising options. Because I think they thought that, you know, the left was going to come, you know, racing in with cash because they thought that they were going to make it, you know, like it's a red hat, blue hat thing. No, Hunter Biden committed a crime. Like anybody else, commit a crime, do the time. But I guess, you know, they're saying that, you know, they thought, you know, hey, people were going to come and donate. Hasn't happened. And they're worried now that, you know, Hunter's not going to have the ability to fund a legal defense. Which, you know, this is why we have, you know, a lawyer will be appointed for you. Now, here's the weird thing. I think even a lawyer appointed for him, gonna get him off of these gun charges. Because as I've been told by a number of people, they never prosecute this as a crime. This is like an add-on that's just thrown on there just to add one more thing that they can take away. And I'm still waiting for the NRA and the gun fetish crowd to show up and defend him. I mean, they're the ones who should be defending him. But again, ideology over, I don't even know. This is politics over ideology. Very, very interesting. Now, finally, J.D. Vance. Evidently, Senator Vance has offered legislation to eliminate the electric vehicle subsidies. You know, tax breaks for, you know, U.S. buyers buying U.S. made vehicles as part of Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. You know, because we want to promote domestic production for domestic consumption. We want to build stuff and we want to buy it. Evidently, he's going to undo those subsidies because he wants gas guzzlers. He wants to make sure that we stay with the gasoline engine. Now, here's the thing. This is the amazing part of this. He knows he can't do this. He knows it's going nowhere. This is what's known as a messaging bill. This is or a fundraising messaging bill, because this is what this is about. This is about him raising money for his campaign coffers or just, hey, to line his pockets. Oh, no, Rick, you can't put that in your pocket. Yeah, you can use it for any political related expenses. I know how the game works. But this is how they fleece the right. Because he's thrown out this idea that we're sticking with gas guzzlers and we're going to crush those EVs. Just send me money. It's going nowhere. It's nonsense. He knows it's nonsense, but he doesn't believe you do. Again, they just lie a little different these days. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Something I said got under your skin, on your nerve, made you think. I want to hear about it. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, podcast always available, shareable. Give it to somebody you know, someone you like, or preferably someone you don't like. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.